Good evening and welcome to the law school. Well, JAG officers, welcome to the law school. I'm Professor Alex Johnson, James C. Slaughter, Distinguished Professor of Law, and the chair of the Law School's Center for the Study of Race and Law. And I've got some big shoes to fill this evening. Originally, President Sullivan was going to introduce Judge Thomas, but she was called away to Richmond at the last minute, and so that task falls to me. But it is my distinct honor and privilege to introduce our keynote speaker, Justice John Charles Thomas, as we honor Dr. King's life and his accomplishments at this event co-sponsored by the Law School and the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Justice Thomas has been a frequent visitor and speaker at this law school, and I've had the distinct pleasure of being in the audience on several occasions and can tell you that based on those presentations, I'm excited to be in the audience this evening and participate in this event. To state that Justice Thomas has had a distinguished legal career is a severe understatement. Justice Thomas is perhaps known first and foremost as a retired justice of the Virginia Supreme Court who, when he was appointed, was the first African-American justice named to that august body. What you probably don't know is that Justice Thomas had a distinguished career before that appointment and has improved on that career since he left that appointment. Although his career represents a series of firsts, which I shall describe briefly, I am happy to note, and I assume he is as well, that Justice Thomas was not the first African-American to graduate from the University of Virginia's School of Law in 1975, having previously received a BA from the undergraduate college in 1972. By 1975, law schools were fortunately matriculating African-Americans in decent numbers, and this law school had admitted its first African-American law student in 1950 and had its first graduate, John Merchant, in 1958. So he was born too late to be the first African-American graduate of this law school. But he's proceeded to make up for that gap in his resume by becoming the first African-American lawyer hired by the prestigious law firm of Hunt & Williams in Richmond, Virginia in 1975. Of course, he also became the first African-American partner at that law firm. Indeed, he was the first African-American lawyer in the history of the American South, that's from Virginia to Texas, to be hired at a white shoe old line law firm like Hunt & Williams and out of law school and then proceed up the line to become a partner. Of course, as I mentioned, he was the first African-American justice appointed to the Supreme Court. What I failed to mention is that he was also the youngest person ever appointed to that body. These firsts are important, but they simply scratch the surface of his accomplishments, which unfortunately I don't have time to relate in sufficient detail. Suffice it to say, Justice Thomas, in addition to his service on the bench, has been a very successful appellate lawyer and a frequent speaker and lecturer across the country and around the world. To give you a sense of some of his accomplishments during his career, I'll mention a few of the highlights. In 1995, Justice Thomas received the NAACP's Lifetime Image Award for his numerous and varied accomplishments. In 2005, he was named a member of the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which is based in Switzerland. In 2006, he was appointed to the Board of Visitors of the College of William & Mary, to which he was reappointed in 2009. He is a member of numerous boards of trustees, including the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, a member of the Appellate Rules Advisory Committee for the Commonwealth of Virginia, and a member of so many bar associations and related entities. They're too numerous to name. So you can see why I'm excited that we have Justice Thomas with us as our keynote speaker to present his talk, which is entitled 50 Years After the Civil Rights Act, 60 Years After Brown, Looking Back, Planning Ahead. I give you Justice John Charles Thomas.
It's a great joy for me to be with you here today. I see some of our brothers and sisters in arms in the auditorium. Hua. You need to know that I also teach at West Point. I've delivered the Cotton Law Lecture to the firsties twice at West Point and talked to the Black and Gold Society. Some of y'all know what that means. But anyway, what I want to say to you is that as we sit here today talking about firsts in history and we sit in a beautiful setting like this, black, white, yellow, brown together, it's not always easy to remember the time in the life of America that led to Brown versus Board 60 years ago, that led to the Civil Rights Act 50 years ago. But as it turns out, I'm 64 years old. And so some of those events are in my lifetime. And so in order to grab your attention as best we can today, to help rivet in place the story of Dr. King, and to make you feel in your gut why the things we have been through are important and preserving what we have achieved is important, let's go back in time. We don't have to go all the way back. We can just go back to when I'm born in 1950, in a time when there was truly American apartheid. I was born at home in a black neighborhood, and we knew the boundaries of the black neighborhood. I'm from Norfolk, Virginia. We knew that it was Church Street on one side, and Tidewater Drive on the other side, and Princess Anne Road on the other side. We knew where we were supposed to be. And there was double everything. There were the black schools, and the black hospitals, and the black police precinct. It was a truly separate society. If we ever went downtown, and they would let us go downtown sometime, because even in the white stores, they wanted green money from black people. But when you went downtown, you had to go up to a window and buy something and leave. Or you had to purchase something on layaway that somebody brought over to you so you wouldn't mess up their store by being colored in the white store. It was brutal. And when you went to the lunch counter, I remember with my own eyes, you would walk, I've done this, you go up to the Woolworth counter to a brass bar at the end of the counter and you order what you want and you go outside and you lean up against the wall to eat it. That's the America that I'm born in 64 years ago. Now that America, when I'm born 1950, is 2 years after what? It's 2 years after Truman issued the order desegregating the army, which was one of the first great changes in our society. Truman, who had fought in World War I, Truman, who understood that everybody bled the same color in war, Truman, who had been beside people of color in the trenches and in the battlefields, Truman knew that to segregate an army that put its life on the line for the nation was the wrong thing to do, and so he desegregated the army. And so you have people coming back from the war, having fought and bled, and by the way, I've been to Pointe-du-Hoc, and I've seen the American Cemetery that's on the top of the cliffs in Normandy, and I've thought about how those men and women died over there, bled for our country, and yet came home, and some German prisoners of war were treated with greater respect and dignity than black soldiers who were over there on that battlefield. It was a brutal time. And as a little child in that time, you knew that you just kind of rode by where white people were and you kind of looked at their stores and you rode by on the big street where they lived and you knew that that was not part of your life. And the reality of it was, y'all might find this hard to believe, but when we went to school, the way things were, this is in my lifetime now, that the books we got were the out-of-date editions, hand-me-down from the white schools. This is what I was educated in for most of my life until 1965, which is, I'll tell you about why that was important. It's a year after the Civil Rights Act. But from the time I go to school in 1956, until 1965, I'm in segregated schools. This is our America. Every book we got had some other child's name in it. The backs were torn off. The little blanks where you filled in the words, they were filled in already, and many times they were filled in wrong, which amazed little colored children because we had been taught that the white children knew everything. And so when we looked in the book and saw that some of the answers were wrong, we go, wow, they must be like us. But so we can laugh a little bit now because, over time things do change. But what I'm trying to say is there was great reason for people who were oppressed and downtrodden. You know, in voting rights, for example, there was such malapportionment that it might be 100 black people would be worth one white vote, just the way they had done the districting, and there was nothing anybody was doing about it. And so your taxes went, you paid taxes if you were black, the white people got the money. You were locked out, intimidated. If you tried to go vote, people would shoo you away. And there were things, in Virginia, listen to this now, you wanted to go register to vote, There was a time when you would be given a blank sheet of paper, and you were supposed to know everything that you were supposed to put on that paper, and you were supposed to know it in order. And if you put all the information on that blank piece of paper, but you didn't put it in the right order, you were not qualified to vote. And so there were poll taxes, literacy taxes, and everywhere you went, there was somebody telling you that you weren't good enough. This is in my lifetime. And so 48, the order desegregating the army. In Farmville, not very far from here, Route 29, 1951, Barbara Johns, who now has a statue on the state capitol grounds, she's a little girl. She tells her classmates, "We can't have this no more. This is crazy. They build tar paper shacks to put us in to educate us, which is what they use for chickens. We've got to protest. We've got to," a little kid. She leads this protest that actually leads to a lawsuit that actually becomes part of Brown versus Board of Education. A little kid in high school, tired, upset, demanding change. And then you got Martin Luther King, 1955. He's down in Montgomery, Alabama. He's the new minister on the block. Taylor Branch writes about this in his book, Parting in the Waters, America in the King Years. King wasn't the old guy. Abernathy was the old minister in town. King was the new guy. The folk were protesting how on the buses, you had to sit in the back, you had to give up your seat for the white people, move to the back, all that. Y'all heard that story. Now, what you might not know is Rosa Parks was not the first person who refused to give up her seat. There was, prior to her, at least one other black woman, but she was pregnant out of wedlock. And the civil rights boys at the time said, "No, no, 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 no. We will never make her the figurehead of a movement, or we will be castigated and called low-down, dirty, filthy people." And so they didn't move on her. But when Rosa Parks does the same thing, they ask her to be the figurehead. Now think about this. This is what I want you to have in your head. We talk about all this stuff now in a classroom, but these things were frightening. When Rosa Parks met with the ministers, including Dr. King, and they said, "Rosa, well, will you let us bring this suit?" Her family was saying to her, "Rosa, don't you know if you do this, the white people will take you to jail and they may lynch you and we may never see you?" It was terrifying. But she trusted Dr. King and the ministers, and she said, "Yes, I will." And so at the beginnings of the movement, they have this mass meeting. I love this scene. And the ministers are in the back doing something, but the people are in the church talking. And somebody, some old farmer, has gotten the mic, and he says, "You know what? All these ministers want to do is ride around in their big Cadillacs and eat their fried chicken, and they want to make us the ones on the front line. The ministers are the ones who want us out there. We're going to be the ones suffering, and we're going to be the ones walking." And at that moment, Dr. King walks into the scene, and he says, "Brother, I will be there with you." And so he was a leader who didn't lead from behind soldiers. He was a leader who said, "I will put myself in harm's way." Just think about that. The places that he went. I mean, our soldiers go to war where they expect hostilities. Now, you're in an American city in the 1950s, and you can go down the wrong road and basically be shanghaied, as they used to say, taken off the ship, carried somewhere, disappear. And that's the life that he was leading, but he said, "Okay, this is what I have to do. These are the times that I live in. This is the fight that I have to fight." And so the bus boycott that went for so many days that made the city relent, because they realized, wait a minute, why are we being stupid? The people who ride the bus are the black people, mostly, because the white people got cars. And so the people who are supporting the bus are the ones that we're making walk to the back. As a matter of economics, at some point they said, "No, we got to stop this," and they moved them out of the way. And so you hear Dr. King, and you hear him in his speeches, and you hear him telling, y'all heard this before, Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Think about that. And guess what I think he was trying to do? He so loved the founding papers of the United States. I mean, the Declaration of Independence and its great aspirational goals, which of course not American law, but was what we aspire to, and the Constitution and all its provisions. He talked about it all the time. And he was saying, wait a minute, if you're gonna have documents like this and you're gonna be a society under law, then how are you not gonna live up to what you said you're gonna do? Now, this idea was reinforced to me just yesterday. I think it may be precisely on his birthday. Y'all may have seen somewhere that they discovered a speech of Dr. King's that they thought had been lost. And in the speech, what he was saying was this: if America only created two documents, I think he might have said these two because he had referred to them all. If America only created these two documents, then its position in history would be imperishable, I think is the word he used. And he said the first document is the Declaration of Independence. And the second document is the Emancipation Proclamation. And so this man who was out there, I mean, it's a very interesting thought for members of JAG, whose job it is in our army around the world to advise on and uphold the rule of law, even in combat. You guys, it's interesting to think that this whole movement led by this man had something to do with the founding documents of the United States. He loved the idea that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit. He loved that so much that he would be thrown into the Birmingham jail. And he would write a letter on pieces of scrap paper that had to be put together later. I hope y'all read the letter from the Birmingham jail. To hear him talk about being in a tiptoe stance as a black man all your life, not knowing where the next threat is going to come from. He really, really, really did not get to live with a lot of peace. Now, it catches my attention. You hear all these achievements and things in my life. I know, and I actually told his wife one time, I found myself standing beside Coretta King at an event, and I said, Ms. King, I'm John Charles Thomas. I was the first black Supreme Court justice in the history of Virginia, but I couldn't have done that without your husband. And so I held her hands, and we sang We Shall Overcome together, and that's something to remember. I mean, history is all around us. But what I'm trying to say to you is our country was broken, damaged, balkanized, rigidly hating in many, many ways. And that it took all these struggles. I mean, it took people putting their lives on the line. You've seen the dogs and the fire hoses in the faces of young children. Have y'all not seen that? If not, you've got to go see Eyes on the Prize. It's because you've got to feel this pain of what it took to create the America that we live with today. And it's not all that long ago now. I mean, this is what? 50, it's in my lifetime. It's not your lifetime necessarily, but it's in my lifetime. And I want to tell you, I met Dr. King on more than one occasion. He came to Norfolk before the I Have a Dream speech to come to one of the churches in Norfolk because he was famous. And the black ministers would have him come. And so he comes to this church in my hometown, and the police decided they are not going to close off the intersections or anything because it's just this black minister. Well, so many black people showed up that they just swamped the intersection. I mean, cars couldn't move. It was like thousands of people. That's how badly people wanted to see him. Well, I got it. This wasn't the church I was raised in, but I get there early. And I go in this church and I'm sitting up in the balcony. I'm like a teenager. I want to see Dr. King. Anyway, so the row is packed. Into the church comes this lady. Some of y'all know how the Black Baptist Church is or whatever church y'all go to. People are proprietary about where they sit. So this lady comes in who goes to this church regularly. And I'm sorry, she was kind of big. And she sees that her seat is taken. And she ain't having no parts of it. Now the row is packed like sardines. This old girl comes in, she said, this massive. And she proceeds to just sit down on top of people. And so folks are just forced all down. So by the time she sits down, we're like leaning over like this, falling off the side of the pew, because we wanted to hear him so badly. And somewhere in one of those speeches, I actually got to shake his hand. Can you imagine a little boy, a little colored kid, up on the stage shaking Dr. King's hand? And then the great speech, the March on Washington. I'm not there. I'm 13. I'm with my granddad, who's an old man by then, sitting by some little teeny black and white TV. But everybody in the black community knew. Now, y'all hear him talk. Y'all hear this stuff. But boy, he could talk. And all the black people knew, like, uh-huh. All them other people talking, taking all that long time. Wait for Dr. King. Because when Dr. King get up there, he's going to turn this place out. We kind of always knew that. That whoever else, you know, other people would, you know, just like I could do you all today, I could say, good evening, class. We're going to look today at the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the long title of which was Section 802.593 of the Code of the United States. I could do that. You could have a little fun with that, maybe. Not. But anyhow, the other speakers would get up and they would be ponderous and all that. But Dr. King would always get up and be like, wow! And so my granddaddy is sitting there and he's yelling and screaming at the television, and I'm sitting beside my granddaddy and I'm yelling and screaming at the TV, all that. Anyhow, Civil Rights Act 1964 comes along. Now, when Brown is decided, I'm 4 years old. So Brown is decided in 54. I go to school in 1956, first grade. School's still segregated. I finish elementary school 1962. School's still segregated. I finish junior high school 1965. School's still segregated. That's 11 years after Brown. That's what you call, y'all ever, all deliberate speed. Y'all heard that? Huh? So listen, soldiers, don't you ever give anybody an order to do anything with all deliberate speed, because what you gonna get back, huh? Decades. Anyway, in Virginia, in 1965, as in other southern states, they decide, aha, we got this figured out. We gonna have something called freedom of choice. Anybody in here ever heard of freedom of choice other than the professors who teach this? You heard of that? Anyway, here's the plan. We are going to preserve the neighborhood schools, you know, which are kind of like racially preserved because the neighborhoods are racially segregated. But any white child who chooses to leave their white school and to go to a black school is free to make that choice. And any black child who chooses to leave their black neighborhood and choose to go to white school is free. Everybody's free. Everybody got choice. We're integrated. This is after, 1 year after Civil Rights Act. Okay. Because one of the things the Civil Rights Act said, remember, 54 Brown decision was about school desegregation. The 64 Civil Rights Act was about integrating our society. And it was about tackling other problems, you know, public accommodations and voting rights and all these things. And so the 64 Civil Rights Act becomes like a turboprop for the 54 Brown decision. In other words, it adds oomph to it. And so after the 64 Civil Rights Act, the courts get active in things like busing and things that they were tepid about before that. And so these things actually run together. They are tied together in effect. So I'm one of these kids from 1965. I'm at the black school. Now, when the black teachers hear about this freedom of choice stuff, they knew that no white kid was going to choose to come to our schools. You know why? Because we wouldn't choose to go to our schools. It's not because we didn't like our teachers. No, really, it's not because we didn't like our classmates. It's because, like, stuff leaked. And it's because we had hand-me-down books. And it's because, like, the heat might not work. And the showers might not work in the gym. That's why. I mean, other than that, you know, we had a reasonably good time. You know, other than leaks and stuff. And so we figured, ain't no white kids coming here. And of course, none did. Not one. Not anywhere in the South. There is not one case of a white kid choosing to leave his school or her school, coming back to school. But the black teacher said, aha, let me tell you what we're going to do. They get me and some other kids. And what they're getting, they always wanted, our folk always wanted, just like I told you about choosing who would do the bus boycott, they always wanted to put in front to the white people somebody that they thought, you know, was upholding the best of our community. And so they're going to get the kids with good grades. All right, I admit it. I had good grades. Shoot me. And so they get us in a room. And they tell us that we have to go to white school. Now, we're babies. We're kids. We're 14, 15 years old. And so, I mean, this is kind of how the movement was. Teacher just gets you in a room. What are we doing here? Y'all, this is actually what we're talking about. Y'all have to, this is the South now. So y'all get over this, because we say this. Y'all have to go to white school. This is how it was described. Y'all have to go to white school. Why? Because we are fighting for integration. And if you don't go, it's going to fail. We need volunteers. Now, here probably sounds like the Army. We need volunteers. Raise your hands right now. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Raise your, yes, raise your, yes, man. So everybody raises their hands. And we get sent to white school. All of us didn't go. I mean, some people quietly changed their minds and didn't go. I wound up at the white school. So you get over there, and remember, we're coming through a society where we've been separate. Everything's been separate. People think they're superior. Other people think they're inferior because you're told that you're inferior. I mean, in your own community, people are trying very hard to say, you're not. You're the best. You can do it. And so we would have the stories of Jesse Owens at the Olympics in Germany, you know, who jumped from behind the line and set a world record, all that. You know what I'm talking about, folks. But anyhow, you had that kind of contention. I wound up over there, and guess what? Even when I was in high school, I had a big mouth. And in high school, I could talk. And in high school, I wind up in advanced English class. And in that particular class, some of y'all heard this story. My friends are in here. They know this story. I had to write a poem, a short story, or an essay, and I wound up writing this poem. And I'm the only black kid in the class. And a teacher takes my poem in front of the class and throws it in my face in front of my white classmates and says, I reject this. I do not believe a colored child could write this. And that's that mindset, you know, ain't no colored children any good, you know, the races should be separate, all these kind of hateful things. But we got over that. You know, I'm here today. But what I'm trying to tell you guys is, as we live in America today, and we think about what we've been through, and I don't want to recount everything, but you can go way back. I mean, you can do the lynchings and the bombings. You know, the church in Birmingham, it always hurts my heart. It was bombed September 15, 1963. That's 3 days before my birthday, and their funeral was on my birthday when Dr. King spoke. I'll never forget it. And I'll never forget how those things would just cut through the black community. Just all those things. When the civil rights workers, the Goodman and Cheney, they were killed down south. It would all just cut through the community. And so you were just afraid about going places and doing things, but you still had to persevere. I mean, we were kind of like little Martin Luther Kings, because part of what he did was powerfully inspirational. I mean, that's why that crowd of people was in the street blocking the cars. And that's why folk follow leaders. That's why when you got that thing that make people, you know, gets their attention, other folk will actually follow you. That's why when you're in a group, you know, you can do more than you can by yourself. And he had that hold on us. He made us think. And so we actually would think. I mean, as young black kids, we would think, I'm doing what Dr. King wants me to do. I actually thought that. Going to the white high school, Dr. King want me to do this. And so I'm doing that. I actually came to UVA thinking the same thing, because I actually came here too. So I've been doing these things, coming to these places. I mean, I come here not to beat up on UVA, but I get to UVA, Confederate flags everywhere, go to the first football game. Now, UVA in those days didn't score many touchdowns. I mean, they had like a 20-some game losing streak or something. But like the first time they scored a touchdown, you know, it's like, what, three black guys in the stands. They take out a Confederate flag and they sing Dixie. Take it across the field on the horse. That's where I'm in school. You know, I come in, this is in our times now. We had this student honor card. I don't know, some of y'all go to UVA, you got the honor card and all that. And they told us when we got here, every merchant in town will take a check from a UVA student because of the honor system. I go somewhere, I got a check, I got my honor card. Some guy didn't want to take my check. I actually laid this man out. I guess that man said, who is this colored child? But I stood somewhere in a store, you gonna take my check? I'm a student at the University of Virginia and this is my honor card. You gonna take my check? He actually took my check. I mean, I suppose in Charlottesville in 1968, I could have been arrested and y'all would have never seen me again. But those little bumps in the road, all those things, I mean, becomes part of our society, it becomes part of us, it becomes part of what we had to overcome, it became part of what the law was striving to do. I mean, what, the preclearance under the 64 Act and dealing with the southern states and reapportionment and all those kinds of things, some of which are being threatened now, some Congress trying to put back in place, all those things. Basically, my notion is this. It was some kind of hard to build the America that we live in today. And the reason that I want you and everybody else to know how hard it was is to make them think, if we ever let this go, if we ever revert to the way we were, if we ever become broken and hate-filled and balkanized again, we might not have the strength to get it back. We might not have Martin Luther King at the moment we need him. We might not have the courage of Rosa Parks at the moment that we need her. And so don't let it go. Keep using the energy that King, you know, he didn't talk about energy, but he said something in one of his speeches. And there are two versions of it. In one version, he's using the song, We Shall Overcome, and he'll say, we shall overcome because truth crushed your earth will rise again. We shall overcome. I mean, he does that. But he does that same thing in another speech where the audience was saying to him, well, how long, Dr. King? How long do we have to suffer? How long do we have to go through this humiliation? How long? In that speech, the refrain is, how long? Not long. Because no lie can live forever. How long? Not long, because a man can't ride your back unless it's bent. How long? Not long, because truth crushed to earth will rise again. How long? Not long, because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Now, that's something that I have always seized on. I mean, I have a little sense of physics and was once a chemistry major, but just think about the arc of the moral universe, the whole tail sweep of the universe. Just look at that great big arc of time and the idea of bending the arc of time. Well, King actually bent the arc of time. And I think that it comes to all of us now to be sure that it stays bent towards justice. And it's easy for it not to be. And you know how we know? We know it because of the second law of thermodynamics. Who in here got some science? Who knows that a system to which no energy is applied devolves into chaos? Anybody know that? Ain't one soldier that knows the second law of thermodynamics. Come on. But what does that mean? I mean, that's the thing against perpetual motion machines and all that. But I say to younger people, well, I'm going to tell y'all are kind of young. I'm going to tell y'all the same thing. What it means in our lives is that if you don't put the energy that it takes to preserve American democracy and justice and fairness, it can very easily go back to the chaotic way that we lived before. It can go back to the brutality of slavery. It can go back to hand-me-down books and broken schools and two of everything in the South. It can go back unless you put your shoulder to it. Because what? If you don't cut the grass at your house, what does it look like, troops? Huh? If you don't wash your uniforms, what do they look like? If you don't tend to American justice, what does it look like? And so all of us have a big job to do. We have to do it to preserve the cases that we fought for and the decisions that we won, the statutes that were approved and passed through and signed by the president. But as I say all this, I don't want to be all down in the mouth. I mean, we could leave here and be all sad. about this journey that we've been on, but I'm not seeking that. Because we actually have seen some change, have we not? I mean, you had Colin Powell, what was he, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, come on. You got a black president of the United States, oh, come on. You had Doug Wilder, a black governor of Virginia. This didn't happen back in 1950. You had me on the Supreme Court. I'm 32 years old. I'm 64 now. I'm double the age I was when I went on the Supreme Court. But I'm 32 years old on the Supreme Court of Virginia, and the next youngest justice is 53, and the oldest is 70. And they ain't never seen nobody like me before. And everybody is old enough to be my daddy. But what we found out is what I hope America understands when we put it all together. When you sit at the table with many different perspectives, viewpoints that come from being a man and a woman and black and white and even being from Rhode Island and Maine and Mississippi and Alabama and being from other countries, when you put all that together, you can understand a little bit more. It's not unlike stereoscopic vision. Anybody remember that from school? Give me a soldier that remembers stereoscopic vision, come on. Your eyes see slightly differently from each side in order to give you a thing called what? Depth perception. Y'all ain't got that? Huh? But when our society puts all those eyes together on a problem, don't you think that we get depth perception? Don't you think America can be better in deciding hard problems when we put all the viewpoints at the table and we don't think that any one is better than the other? So this is what I'm saying to you. Dr. King was a powerful soldier for change, and he was the way he was because he believed in the founding creeds of America, and he decided that he was going to give his life to make us live up to what we said we were. And so here we are in a changed society that is a little better than it was when it started, but that can change very quickly. It can revert very quickly unless we do our best. That's what I got to tell y'all. Any questions? Well, then I'm going.